welcome to Charity Chat. I'm your host, Rachel Conroy. In this episode, I sat down with Mark Hughes, founder of MCH Positive Impact, and Michelle Benson, founder of Culture of Philanthropy, to talk about strategies and philosophies around effective time management. Mark and Michelle bring a wealth of experience from their individual careers to the discussion. They've never met before, but you wouldn't know from the instant rapport they had for the episode, which allowed us to delve into both theoretical and practical takeaways. Plus, there were some great book recommendations along the way to help you manage your time. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Charity Chat. I'm very pleased today to be joined by Mark Hughes, founder of MCH Positive Impact, and Michelle Benson, founder of Culture of Philanthropy. How are you both today?
Very well, thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Rachel.
Fantastic. Well, today we'll be talking all about time management and some kind of effective skills that we can pass on to our listeners and some top tips. So very excited to dig into that both with you today. But before we start, just learn a little bit about the two of you as well. So Mark, what is your background and how did this lead to you setting up MCH Positive Impact?
So I've had quite a meandering career. So I started life as a research chemist. So I am a doctor, believe it or not. I'm not a medical doctor, not a useful doctor, but a doctor of philosophy and chemistry. And after, 7 years training, having worked in academia and both industry, realised that I didn't feel that chemistry was really, I guess, going to fit with what I valued in life, namely using my privilege, my good fortune to have a positive impact in the world. So after a bit of soul searching, I decided to look into perhaps working in government, perhaps the diplomatic service. So I did some more further study and did a master's in diplomacy and trade. And that actually helped me decide that, yes, it wasn't going to be working in government because I didn't like the way decisions were made. And particularly in terms of from an equality perspective, I didn't feel that sometimes the decisions made in government really had equality at their heart. So that then led me to consider working in the charitable sector. But a PhD in chemistry, a master's in diplomacy and trade, wasn't hugely useful to a typical charity. But what I'd found during that time in academia and industry and studying was that although I perhaps didn't have a particular sector within the charitable sector that I was passionate about, whether that's animal welfare or health or youth work or whatever it may be, what I felt I could add value to was management and leadership within that sector. So I joined an international management consultancy firm, a firm called McKinsey, that worked primarily with private sector organizations, but with a view very much to learn the management and leadership skills that I could then use to be of value in the sector. And after a couple of years, when I felt I knew enough to be useful, I started looking for opportunities. And this was at the time when I was living in Australia. And I had the real privilege of becoming chief executive of an organization called Rumbalara, which is an Indigenous sporting and community development organization. It essentially uses sport as a means of helping the Indigenous community with health, employment, education, those types of issues. Due to personal reasons and also visa restrictions, my time in Australia came up. So I came back to the UK. There weren't too many Indigenous sports clubs to manage. So I started looking for full-time employment within the charitable sector here. And although a few things came up, nothing really, drove me. I was passionate about. But what did come up was short-term consultancy pieces of work. And very soon, actually, I stopped looking for full-time work because what I found was actually helping with either consultancy and then latterly in terms of staff development was just a really good use of these past lives, because having worked in academia in the private sector, in the charitable sector, in government, I've worked with literally hundreds of different teams within all sorts of organizations on various continents, and I've started to see trends in terms of what it takes to be consistently successful as an individual, as a team, and as an organization. So it was just a really good use of my past lives. Now, I guess it's interesting, I'm not interviewed formally very often, but whenever I was, I could always tell when somebody was looking at my CV for the first time in the interview, because there'd just be this kind of frown starting to appear on their face, and that, you know, this guy just can't make up his mind. He was a chemist, and then he was a, you know, trainee diplomat, and then he worked as a consultant, and then he was when the Chad was there. You know, he doesn't know what he's about. And there may be some listeners who are starting to reach that same conclusion, but there is actually a commonality here in all my career choices, and that is that they were driven by my values. They were driven by a desire to have a positive impact and to use my good fortune. And I experimented in a number of ways, but there were some central values. Now, I know you're going to talk about, you know, the importance of goals when it comes to time management. But I guess just as a precursor to that discussion, I think that would be my, you know, first offering to this discussion, that actually it's far easier to manage one's time if you really know your values and let those values guide your goals and therefore where you spend your time. But yeah, more on that later, perhaps.
Brilliant. Thanks, Mark. Well, yeah, no frowns from Michelle or me there, I think that was fair to say. So yeah, really interesting to hear your career path. So yeah, Michelle, how did your kind of work lead you to founding Culture of Philanthropy?
Well, I worked in, I used to work in the States. I was working for a marketing agency, and then I came over to back to England and started to work for Shelter as a corporate fundraiser. So I started in corporate fundraising. I worked in fundraising for 18 years, and in that I worked for big charities as well as really tiny ones you've never heard of. And eventually I became a fundraising director of a number of charities. So I worked a lot across lots of income streams. And then after 18 years of that, I jumped over the fence and I started to work for a trust fund. So I went from being a fundraiser to being a funder. And even though I'd had 18 years of working in fundraising, when I started working on the funding side of the fence, I was really, really surprised how much everybody knows everybody and everybody's talking to everybody. And even though I was a trust fund, I started to do joint funding with corporates, major donors and their advisors and other trust funds. So not only did I start to just get to know absolutely everybody in my funding space, but I was also working with trust funds, CSR, marketing teams, individual philanthropists, and everybody knows everybody and everybody's talking to everybody and everybody's recommending who they're working with and who they're not working with. And there are even forums. So there are various forums. So not only do you see people physically, but even back then we were all like online talking to each other, recommending who we're working with and blah, blah, blah. But one of the things that really struck me was the vast majority of people absolutely did not want an open application process. Everybody wants to, because it takes a huge amount of staff. If you open up your application process, you get floodgates, and then it's, you know, it's really time consuming. There's this thing called the internet. You can find stuff. You don't need to wade through like 50,000 applications. You can go online, you can talk to other funders, and you can find things yourself. So every funder that I was going into a joint fund with said, happy to do joint funding on one condition, no applications. We find them, they don't find us. So that was number one. Number two, every time someone tried to, if we locked the door and people tried to pick that lock, it would really annoy people. So if you're a fundraiser and you're saying, well, it's a closed application form, maybe my trustee can introduce us or stuff like that, you're just going to pick the lock and you're going to turn up into our world as the problem we are trying to avoid. If, however, we are proactively looking, because if you say no applications, that means you are proactively looking. So if you are proactively looking and we find you, we get super excited. So we're great, this one's great. Yeah, and so basically being found, you enter our world as a solution we're looking for. Trying to pick the lock, you enter our world as a problem we're trying to solve. So as a fundraiser, obviously you want to start relationships with people. Starting that relationship by, you know, basically upsetting them isn't a good idea, right? So I then started to think, if ever I go on back to fundraising, I'm going to be found. I'm going to put myself in the pathway of where these guys are looking, and I'm going to be there. I'm going to be their solution. And so I started to work with charities on how to be found, particularly using LinkedIn. So LinkedIn is where people are looking. It's easy for you to connect with people there. And also it's easy for you to be found there, and it's easy for you just to start conversations and whatnot. So I started an online course, basically is how to use LinkedIn to fundraise, which is basically how to be found by funders who are looking. And then that became my full-time job as in 2018. And from that, and now I still work on the funding side of the fence. I do consultancy for funders who are looking, and I also work with fundraisers on how to be found. So, A, I think it's really, really effective way because you're working with your market, but I also think it makes your job more enjoyable because I think the fundraising job of trying to chase people that don't want to be chased sucks. It's really stressful, it's ineffective, and it makes you miserable. Whereas if you've got a process where you go, I just go on LinkedIn, I just comment and like, and I make friends, and guess what? People DM me and come to me. It's a much more effective and enjoyable way of fundraising. So that's where my focus is these days.
And Michelle, has there been a trend in more closed funders, as it were? I mean, I'm just really interested in that idea, and it makes a lot of sense. I'm just wondering, what direction the arrow is going, the extent to which, that actually more philanthropic organizations are choosing to be closed and proactively look, or whether it's, relatively stable or it's reduced. Yeah, it'd just be good to get a sense of that.
I think it's probably increasing
Right.
because the problem is the more people that close their doors, the more pressure goes onto the people with open. So if you and I had an application process, and loads of other people started closing their doors, we would get increased applications, which then puts pressure on us to close ours as well. So obviously, the bigger trust funds and even some of the little ones still have an open application process. I'm working with a trust fund at the moment who has an open application. But because they're being so overwhelmed with applications, they keep closing and opening, closing and opening. So actually, that's the impact on they refuse to close their application from. They're like, no, we're going to stay open. But again, so yesterday they closed it again yesterday just to get the backlog. And they probably won't be open again for another 6 weeks. Whereas historically, that never in 150 years, that trust fund has never closed an application form ever. But now they're open, shut. So, yeah. So I think from a fundraising point of view, to say, I have a target market who has a closed application process as well as an open one, and I have no strategy for the close, only for the open, is obviously dodgy. And there's no reason not to have a strategy. You just have one, basically.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Michelle. And I think a lot of our listeners will appreciate that opening nuggets from you as well there. So getting into the crux of the topic for today, all around time management, let's start with quite an open question for you, Michelle. So what advice would you give someone to get the most out of each working day?
Well, the first thing I'd say is go virtual. No, I am. So basically, the people I work with, I think they have a fight on their hand. So there is what I call fundraising success versus job success. So fundraising success is I've got to go out there and I've got to get new funders as well as steward my current donors. So fundraising success is when you are in front of your donors, you're working on your case of support, you're maybe putting, you're gathering your case studies, your breakdown of your budget, you're organizing project visits, i.e. all the things that are going to push the fundraising forward. That is fundraising, that's fundraising, right? However, you then have to balance it between job success. And job success says, keep on top of all the internal meetings, keep on top of all the internal emails, keep on top of all the internal reports, all that stuff that is never going to move the needle on the fundraising, but you need to do in order to be successful at your job. So that's the fight. And unfortunately, the job success often sucks up all the time away from the fundraising success. But at the end of the year, no one's going to go, listen, I know you didn't meet your target, but you know, your reports have been bloody marvelous. And by God, you return an email quickly. You know, that's not going to be what you're judged on, right? So the reason I love introducing charities to using LinkedIn and or whatever social media is relevant to their target market. I've worked, just to say also, I work with people that don't even have a LinkedIn account, never ever done any social media in their life. So I'm not to people that live on it, you know, it varies. But fundamentally, if you set up your LinkedIn account and in the mornings or whatever time of day, if you go in and connect with some funders and then start liking and commenting on funders' posts, you are going to be seen by the funder that you're liking and commenting on, as well as all the other funders that are reading that post. You could do that for half an hour, like, comment, send some invitations out, and then close down LinkedIn and then start your day job. Whilst you're sitting in that internal meeting or writing those internal reports or emails, virtual you is out in the world being read. That cycle's 24 hours. So for the next 24 hours, virtual you is on the outside working, and real you is doing whatever you do. So basically, it's two yous, one salary. So ultimately, it's fantastic, especially I work with so many really, really, really tiny charities, especially founders and people that are wearing like 100 hats. It's just great to be able to say, you know, if I've left a comment and 700 funders are reading my comment, how else are you going to get in front of 700 funders by writing a comment that took you 2 minutes? So it's a really effective way of basically leveraging your time and balancing that fight between fundraising success and job success.
Thanks, Michelle. I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about it. And obviously the listener can't see, but I was nodding away enthusiastically. I've just come off a very heavy internal facing week with my meetings. So yeah, I think I've probably myself, I do try and use LinkedIn, but I probably go through phases and I might have like a month where I'm very active and then just kind of goes to the background. But I really like that idea a bit, like the kind of traditional time management of, you know, that first hour of the day, maybe on emails before you get into your work, thinking, okay, well, where else can I make sure I'm really out there? And like you said, just kind of having that half hour to really kind of put that virtual you out there. I love that idea.
Yeah.
Mark, was there anything else you wanted to add on that topic?
I mean, I think in terms of, I mean, there are some tactical tips that I use for time management, but they're perhaps almost as much about what to avoid rather than what to do, which I know we'll come on to. I think my tips are more around, I suppose, like slightly more, you know, fundamental aspects, which, you know, in terms of values and those types of things, which I'm happy to talk about now, but we can obviously leave them till later.
Great, thanks, Mark. Yeah, I think this does lead nicely into our next question, as you said. So, and you touched a little bit, like you said, in your precursor, in your intro there. So, how crucial do you think goal setting is to effective time management, and what methods would you advise to ensure your goals align with your time management approach as
Yeah.
well?
Surprise, surprise, I'm going to start with values. You know, I genuinely feel that if you really know your values and you live your values, they will absolutely then help you direct where you should be spending your time. So there's a, you know, there's a fundamental aspect. You know, all the jobs that I've had have really fitted with some really core values of mine, not least equality and trying to reduce inequality. So I think, and I think most people, and I'm not alone in this, would rather spend, you know, 10 hours a day working on something that they're passionate about rather than 8 hours a day that they cannot stand doing. It is just a drain on their, you know, well-being. So values can really help in those big decisions. You know, what jobs do I do, and crucially, what I don't do. But I think values can also help on a, a weekly, daily level. So, another couple of core values of mine are balance and relationships. And now, how does that inform my week, my month, my year? Well, I really do ensure that I don't do MCH work on a Monday, because I want to anchor myself at home. Often with my work, I travel. But by not working on Mondays, I anchor myself at home so I can always be there to drop off, pick up my kids from school. And also I can ensure that I can just deal with life stuff, and so that then I can focus on MCH stuff Tuesday to Friday. And on a daily basis, another core value of mine is health, particularly physical health. And where that drives me is that even if I have a busy day like today, the first thing that goes in my diary is, well, when am I going to go for a walk? When am I going to go for a run? When am I going to do just 5 minutes of meditation? They are the things that go in first, and they're driven by my values. And I think often what gets in first is often what gets completed. So values would be my number one. And in terms of, it can be that ephemeral, what do we mean by values? And it's almost, without being too obvious about it, it's anything that you feel passionate about. They're often beliefs that drive action. How to go about really tuning into them, there's probably three resources I'd strongly recommend. One is a book called Because by Shannon Banks. Second one is Dare to Lead by Brené Brown. And the third is Finding Your Why by Simon Sinek. They all have exercises on, yeah, how to really tune into your values and ideally prioritize them as well. If you don't fancy a book, just actually, Googling, common values, and look at a list and which ones resonate with you. Or lastly, just reflect on, what are the things that trigger you, both positive and negative, because anything that genuinely really you have a strong emotional reaction to, there's probably a value sitting under belief, underneath those emotions. So that'd be my top tip. Secondly, I think linked to values, but also talking about your competency and needs and to agree beliefs as well. If you could think of like four dimensions, what are you good at? What do you enjoy? What do you feel has a purpose bigger than yourself? And lastly, what do you like to be praise that? Where do you feel you're making progress? And generally, the sweet spot of work is at the intersection of those four dimensions. And the good news is that you generally have a lot of choice on, what you're good at, what you enjoy, and what gives you purpose. And that again helps direct you to find hopefully a role that fits with who you want to be. And that, being praised and feeling that you're making progress, well, that's where you are to an extent dependent on management. But this is where I think you've got to back yourself, if at all possible, and say, if I'm in an environment where I don't feel I'm being praised, I don't feel I'm making progress because of the environmental conditions, well, there is an element of, well, where can I find that elsewhere? So they would be the fundamental aspects. Although it's not perhaps a goal-setting piece, I think another really important aspect of time management relates to mindset. And for me, what's helped me from a mindset perspective is to realize that my time management, particularly within a team environment, it's all down to a negotiation. And I think people are understanding that my time is a negotiation with my manager, with my other staff members, is a really important mindset shift. And to recognize that any conversation I'm therefore having with my manager is effectively a negotiation, and therefore I'm going to approach it that way. And I think one of the top tips for negotiation is making sure you've got really good information and a good backup. And so when I was a chief executive and I was being asked to do all sorts of things by my board, what really helped me was to really measure and know how much time certain things took, and then take it to the board and say, well, here is my to-do list. It is currently sitting at 12 hours. You're asking me to do something else. I'm happy to do that. But please, can you then tell me what I need to take away, or what time frames I can lengthen? And so it's not a direct no, but it's very much it's using and understanding that your time is a valuable resource that therefore you're going to negotiate over. And I think that can be really helpful. And then lastly is expectation. Within the charitable sector, I think if you have an expectation that every day of every week and every month is going to be perfectly balanced, you're going to be really disappointed. And so I think there is an expectation that, yes, there will be times of the year when you are just flat out. And I think it's important to accept that. The crucial thing then is to accept that there should be lulls, and to really give yourself permission to take those lulls, to leave, you know, or stop work at 4 because, you know, you've worked till 7 or 8 the previous month. So you are going to have those lulls, and to enjoy the lulls so that over, if you like, the season or the calendar year, yes, on average, it's balanced, but recognizing that there are peaks and troughs. So they would be my kind of top three, just really tuning into the values, really thinking of those 4 dimensions of what am I good at, what am I passionate about, stroke and joy, you know, what gives me a sense of purpose, and am I getting the making the progress and getting the encouragement I need, and taking ownership of those areas where you can. Treating any discussion on your time management as a negotiation, and then also just recognizing that there will be peaks and troughs, and making sure that you really enjoy those troughs, those lulls. Now, I say there's lots of tactical stuff, but in my experience, it's almost what not to do rather than what you should be doing. And I know we're going to talk about the common mistakes and pitfalls, so I'll leave that till later.
Yeah, great, Mark. And that your final point on those lulls, I think that's really important. The listeners know I work at Movember, which is obviously a campaign based organization, so the peaks are high. Yeah. when it's campaign time. But you know, we're trying as an organization as well to have a collective appreciation of the lulls, and we just do little things like on Slack, if you're taking, we call it flex time now, and we have like a muscle flexing. Oh, so it works both ways. Yeah. It's like I'm taking the time back, but it's also a strength, and we're trying to bring that down from like senior management down, so that you know more junior members of staff can see that that's okay, and you can take flex time as well when the balance of your week requires it. And I think that point on negotiation of your time is important as well, because I think people, when they're in the throngs of feeling very, very busy, feel they can't even step back and say, well, this is actually why I'm busy. And this is, like you said, taking to your board or your manager, like this is what's taking up my time. So I think that's super important to consider. And that leads, nicely to our next question, I think, for Michelle on what advice do you have for individuals who may feel overwhelmed by their workload or obligations?
Yeah, definitely. I would say, listening to what you guys were just talking about, somebody once said to me, no is a full sentence. And I love that. And I would say, you know, if you can't do it and it's a no, that is a full sentence. You don't have to constantly justify what you can and cannot do. So if somebody's feeling completely overwhelmed by their workload and their obligations, first of all, I would say, let's take a step back and really think, is my job actually doable? Because one of the classic things in fundraising in the charity sector is we take one job description and we put 6 jobs in there, and then we hand it over to someone. And so ultimately, have you got one of those jobs, which there's a high chance that you're feeling overwhelmed, not because you can, you know, no time management under the sun is going to make up for the fact that you're being handed a job that is impossible. So that's number one. Are you actually doing a job that's doable, or is your job description really 3 people's jobs in one, and you're trying to stretch yourself so incredibly thin that you are overwhelmed? So that in that case, you really need to start going and pushing back on, do I have a realistic job? So that would be number one. Let's say you do have a realistic job, or you're trying to figure out if you do. One of the things that I found really helpful is to go, okay, what are the key objectives of my jobs? What are the goals that I'm really trying to achieve? And what I do is I make 3 lists. The first list is the crucial list. So if I'm going to achieve all these objectives, what crucially has got to happen? What do I absolutely have to do that's not, is just not non-negotiable? That becomes a crucial list. Then your second list is, what are all the reoccurring things that I do? So maybe I'm a line manager and I have one-to-ones with my team, or I, you know, I'm a, you know, I have the weekly team meeting, or whatever the recurring things that you do that. And then your third list is your to-do list. Now, when you do this exercise, what's really interesting is the to-do list is generally everything you're doing for other people. It generally turns out to be the things that other people have asked you to do, and therefore you need to do them. And so what you can often see is that the crucial list is non-urgent, and it's the crucial stuff that doesn't have a human at the end of it or a deadline at the end of it. It can kind of wait. So the crucial stuff tends to get pushed down to the bottom of the to-do list. And everybody else is kind of in, you know, urgent deadlines, blah, 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 go up the list. So what you end up doing is you're constantly responding to all these, like reply to the emails, do this, that, and the other, la-di-da, knowing damn well that the crucial stuff isn't getting done. And that can lead to the stress and the worry. Again, it comes back to that time management. It's like, identify your crucial list and put time in your diary that is non-negotiable, that you are going to get that stuff done, because that's the stuff that you are, you know, paid to do, as it were. Manage the recurring stuff so that it is manageable as possible. And so, can those hour meetings be a half an hour meeting? Do those weekly meetings really need to be weekly, or whatever? And then to-do list. That's when we come back to what you and Mark were just saying in terms of, you know, no is a full sentence, and push back. And also, by doing those lists, I think you're really going to see whether you have a realistic job. Because if your crucial list is vast, then obviously that's not doable. There is also, I heard a neuroscientist describe overwhelm. Actually, it's a form of fear, it's worry and stress. It's real. So we've all heard of the fight and flight. You know, you either stand and fight, you run away, or you freeze in fear. Overwhelm is actually the actual neurochemicals of freezing in fear. You're overwhelmed, so you're frozen. Procrastination is a neurochemical that goes through your body that makes you want to run away and avoid. And perfectionism is the, I'm just going to stand here and fight it out. I'm not going to run away. I'm going to fight like hell. So actually, perfectionism, overwhelm, and procrastination are actually physical neurochemicals of your reaction of there's something you're worried about. It's stressful, you're fearful. So again, that's a sign that there's something wrong.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating, Michelle.
Yeah, and just to pick up on a couple of your points made, Michelle, I think it's a great point about, first of all, just ask yourself the fundamental question: is my job realistic? And I certainly, as a, you know, as somebody who delivers staff development training, you know, occasionally a client will come to me, a charity will come to me, and says, "Oh, we want resilience training for our staff." And when I ask them, I have to, you know, I reach the conclusion I have to tell them I don't think resilience is the problem. You know, your staff seem incredibly resilient as they are. The problem is you've set them an unrealistic strategy. You've provided targets with which just don't have enough people or enough hours in the day to achieve. And no amount of resilience training will do that. So I think that's key. And something, again, this is where I think it does link to negotiation of what can help in that, then that discussion is being really precise and measuring, you know, this is how long things are taking me, and this is how many things I've got. And as you can see, just there are not enough hours in this day to do what's required. And just as, you know, I kind of something that I found quite useful is to be really aware of what's often termed the planning fallacy. And that is where we often expect tasks to take a lot less time than they actually take. Because what we do is we base it on our past experience of the best occasion when it went perfectly, rather than the average amount of time it has taken. So something that I found is that, what's my first estimate of that? I will often increase it by 50%, and that's far more accurate. So just
Yeah.
be really aware of that planning fast, let's say. So if you are in one of those jobs, you then can take accurate information to your manager and just say that, I'm really confident that this is how long things are taking, and there's not enough hours in the day. And I think the other aspect you talked about, which is that I think is absolutely key, is recognizing that often your to-do list fills up with other people's requests. And if somebody wants to delve into that in a little bit more detail, there's a really quite nice article from the Harvard Business Review called Who's Got the Monkey? And the monkey analogy is that any conversation that you have, often in the workplace, invariably involves the transfer of one monkey from you
Yeah.
to somebody else. So, Michelle, if you and I are, let's say, working together, and we're preparing a report for the trustees of our board, if I say to you, "Oh, Michelle, could you just proofread the final report?" Essentially, I'm handing over the monkey, which is
Yeah.
proofreading, to you. And now that might be the right thing to do, because you're a much better proofreader, and we've agreed that that's the case, and you know more of the actual report than I do. I was a bit part player in it, but it may not be. It may be that actually it's my responsibility ultimately, but I'm trying to pass it on to you. And this idea of monkeys, I think, is quite helpful, that you don't need to take on too many monkeys from other people until, you've just got a whole bunch of monkeys in your room that they're just running amok. And so I think that, the lesson I've learned from painful experience is only take monkeys that are your responsibility, that you want to take, and be very clear that that's what's happening in this discussion. That is what's happening, is the transfer of one monkey from one person to another, and just keep track of, your monkeys. But yeah, the Who's Got the Monkey? Harvard Business Review. If you Google it or search engine it, it's widely available.
But I would also add to that, that's why it's so important to really do your crucial list. Because if you've done your crucial list and you've said, right, this is the stuff that I need to do, and it's utterly crucial for me to do my job. But let's say I'm feeling really worried about it. So it says things like, go out and get the new business. And I'm thinking, you know what? I don't think I'm that up to the scratch. I'm slightly worried that I'm not capable of that so much. You giving me a monkey is a godsend. Because
Perfect.
now it's procrastination.
Yep.
So you can keep me really busy. Thank God for Mark,
Yep.
because I would have done the new business or the stuff that I'm actually really scared of. But you know what? I'm now going to be super busy over here with Mark's monkeys because, I'm procrastinating. So I love your monkeys, Mark. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. And so again, it's that kind of, it's really understanding if this is my crucial list. I'm like, when I read that list, what physical reaction have I got? My legs gone a little bit jelly-like, or is it that voice in my head gone, yeah, right, good luck with that? It's those things you need to address as well, because otherwise that procrastination kicks in. And delay, I think, is the number one enemy of success. It's, you it's all, especially in fundraising, you need that fundraising runway. You need a good amount of time. And if you're procrastinating and, and pushing everything to the end of the year, because guess what? It doesn't come with a deadline. It's not coming with a human bugging you or whatever. Then you're on that slippery slope.
Yeah, it's a great point. And yeah, that kind of monkey management, it requires both. It requires perhaps not to ask as much of other people, but it also requires you as an individual to be quite self-aware and self-regulated to know, yeah, I'd really like to do that, because it will actually avoid me doing the really important
Yeah.
job. And it's about being having real integrity with yourself. I think that's a great point,
Yeah.
Michelle.
And no, and by the way, when I say that, no judgment, I'm saying that from lived experience. I've been shocking at procrastination and taking on monkeys. So I'm no judgment from me on that one.
Yeah, I think it's really important, like you both said, to understand, like with this monkey analogy, like what, like you said, why you're taking on the monkey. Is it because I have a fear of doing something else? But for me, I think a recurring theme that comes up a lot in our episodes, and it links to your point about values, Mark, that you've been making throughout, is that a lot of people are in the sector through choice, through because they have a reason and a purpose to be here, and linked to that, one of the key skills of being in the charity sector on whole is great relationship management skills. So I think sometimes when you're working internally and you're taking on these kind of monkeys, as it were, there is also an innate thing in a lot of people to maintain positive relationships with your colleagues and with those people you're working with as well. So I think there's a combination there, like you said, of like thinking why you're doing it, and are there other reasons for this as well?
And I think also just thinking the short term and the long term, because you're right, I think a lot of people they want to be helpful. The problem is if you start taking too much of other people's stuff, you become a bottleneck, because then people are waiting for you to finish, or to complete, the task that they need to get on. And I say if you've taken on too many things from other people, yeah, you become the bottleneck. Because what happens if you get unwell, or ill? Things stop. And so I think it's thinking, in the longer term and for the good of the whole team and the whole organization, is this the right thing for me to be doing? I think it's
I
key.
would also add to that, everything compounds. I don't know if you've read the book by James Clear, Atomic Habits, but he makes a fantastic example where he says, okay, if I was smoking and I smoke every day, that one, two, three, four cigarettes doesn't, it's not going to do me any damage, really. But if I carry on smoking for years, it's the compounding effect of that habit that builds up and therefore does the damage. Equally, if I was to jog every day, that one walk or that one run isn't really going to do much good, really. But if I jogged for the next 3 years, it's the compounding habit that builds up, and therefore you get the benefit out of it. So everything, all these routines and these habits you get into compound. So you may be taking on too many monkeys, and it's sort of like, oh, it's only once a week and blah, blah, blah. But you've got to think of it like that one cigarette. It compounds and has a longer term effect. Or if you're good habits, so his quote is, we rarely raise to the level of our goals. We're more likely to fall to the level of our habits. So habits and routines are fabulous, especially for time management, because if you can set out a good routine and a good habit, you don't even have to think about it. You just do it. It's part of your day. It's what you do. And it's all that compounding effect that then pays off big at the end of the year, whether you're achieving those goals or not.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Michelle. And I think we've covered so much today around like tips and touching on like common pitfalls as well that people go along the way. I think we've probably got time for one more question open to the floor. What advice would you have on time management that may benefit the more neurodivergent community?
Well, I would say, because I think I might be in this camp, and I'm pretty sure my son is as well. I think visual schedules, putting everything in your diary, having it planned out, but having some sort of actually where you can see things laid out visually is incredibly helpful. Obviously, things like timers. So if you really want to try to focus on things, if you say, right, for the next 20 minutes, I am going to focus purely on X. And there's all those Pomodoro techniques and things where you set a timer for 20 minutes, you do nothing but, try to do one task at a time. Avoid multitasking, because multitasking is definitely going to set you off on all different routes. And then, of course, so routine, habits, timers, visual, but also breaking your day into chunks is also a good one. So you've got two parts of the morning, midday, two parts of the afternoon, and so you chunk things, and then you allocate yourself time and tasks, and you become quite rigid about it. If I've set up, so don't put in your diary for at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they're going to jump on LinkedIn for half an hour. For half an hour, I'm going to jump on LinkedIn, make three connections, four likes, and two comments. That would be my take.
Great, thanks, Michelle. Anything else from you, Mark, on
I
this area?
very much endorse Michelle's take on the visual timers. I've found, help people in the neurodivergent spectrum. I think something else that other people who I've spoken to about this have found helpful is actually if you can have a management buddy where you have a joint, system, I'll check on you check on me. But I think a lot of the tips I'd give to the neurodivergent, I'd also give to most people. I think Michelle's already touched on it. The biggest problem I think is often we think we can multitask, and a tiny minority of us can multitask well. But just the neuroscience is pretty clear on this. We are terrible at multitasking, even if we think we are not. We're terrible, so just don't. And I think also that structuring time. Yeah, I think keeping control of your diary is key. Yeah, I think what I think a lot of people do, they just don't block out their diary. They have, their Outlook calendars on so they can see when emails are coming on. So just again, linked to multitasking. If you're doing writing a report, just switch off your Outlook. Make sure your phone is, on silent and ideally not in sight. And I think I like Michelle's take on, yes, you're really blocking things out and being rigid. And I think a key word that comes to mind is a degree of balance of being both rigid and fluid. So I think yes, absolutely, get into these habits where you're blocking out time, but to enable the fluidity. Something that I've found really useful is when I am planning my day, my week, my month, I make sure that 10% of the time is not as yet unallocated. Now it's going to be filled by something, but I just don't know what it is yet. And I think having that cushion, that window of time, that's I think is quite empowering, and it allows you to flex so that yes, if the unexpected happens. You do have that contingency. So I think, yeah. And I think the final closing remark, which comes from Martin Edwards, who's the chief executive of the hospice Julia's House in both Wiltshire and Dorset. And it links to what the biggest waste of time is. And a lot of people, when you ask, what's the biggest waste of time? They'll often say meetings or emails. But his quote is, no, the biggest waste of time is doing the wrong things really, really well. And I think that very much summarizes a lot of what, Michelle and I have been saying. I think if you focus and you start doing things that, really aren't yours to be doing, you're doing the wrong things really, really well. So yeah, that'd be my closing thought to everyone, whether you're neurodivergent or not, is yeah, keep asking yourself, am I doing the wrong things really, really well? Because if I am, that is the biggest waste of time.
Oh, well, yeah, thanks, Mark. I think that's a really kind of thinker for all of our listeners to close on. And yeah, thank you so much for your time today, both to Mark and Michelle. I think there's been some fascinating topics picked up, both in terms of you kind of the broader values and then thinking about more practically on your day to day. So yeah, thank you both for being amazing guests with us today.
It's been a real pleasure, and thanks very much for putting on this podcast. I think it's incredibly laudable what you do, Rachel. So thank you.
It's been wonderful. It's really good. Been really fun. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
A big thank you to Michelle and Mark for sharing their expertise with us. The importance of understanding your values in order to help you decide where to direct your time came up on a number of occasions. Don't be afraid to use your time as a negotiation tactic with those who are asking you to complete tasks and practically show people how long certain tasks take. If the hours in the day just don't add up, then this means the expectations on your job are unrealistic and this needs to be flagged. Our modern way of working presents both challenges and opportunities, but something I had never considered is how you can make virtual you work to your benefit. Spending some time in the morning on a platform like LinkedIn can help build both your personal brand and awareness of your organisation whilst you are cracking on with all of those day-to-day tasks. This is particularly helpful if you're in a fundraising role or a role that requires you to build relationships and really sell the aims of your charity. Practical solutions were smattered throughout the conversation with Michelle and Mark, but some of my favourites were creating a crucial list, a recurring list, and a to-do list, making yourself a visual schedule, pairing yourself up with a time management buddy, and, very importantly, making sure you always allow yourself a 10% cushion whenever you're mapping your time out. So thanks for listening to Charity Chat. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. You can find us on Twitter or LinkedIn to share your thoughts, or email us on charitychatpodcast@gmail.com. Please do like and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode, and share with any colleagues or friends who may be interested. It's just left for me to say thank you to Magda Askamit for our beautiful website. Check it out at charitychat.org.uk. And also a big thank you to Forest of Fools for playing throughout the show and for playing us out now. I've been your host, Rachel Conroy. Thank you again for listening.